I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. This show brings together leaders, thinkers, and advocates to have serious conversations about the ideas shaping our communities, our economy, and our future. These conversations are designed to move beyond headlines and sound bites so we can better understand the forces shaping the world around us. If you find value in these conversations, I invite you to support this platform. Your donations help us continue producing independent discussions with economists, business leaders, policymakers, and community voices across North Carolina. You can support the show by visiting lockedin.cash and becoming a supporter. Today's guest is Dr. Roy Cordato, Senior Economist Emeritus with the John Locke Foundation, where he has spent decades analyzing public policy, economic growth, and the impact of government decisions on markets and communities. Today, we're going to take a deep look into the domestic economy, tariffs, inflation, economic growth, and what it all means for North Carolina. Roy, welcome to the show, man. Thank you for locking in with me. It's been a while since I seen
you. Yeah, it sure has. Glad to be here, Algernon. Happy to do this.
Awesome. And I guess for my audience, because I know you very well, I know some of the work that you did at John Locke. I know you're retired now. But for my audience, maybe just talk a little bit about, at a high level, some of the work you used to do for the John Locke Foundation.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I was first vice president for research there, starting back in 2001, for a very long time. And then I became senior economist, resident scholar, and I worked on lots of things. I mean, my main areas were taxation. I did a lot of work, and probably the prime mover between in terms of writing research on tax reform proposals that came out of the Locke Foundation, much of which was behind the 2013 North Carolina tax reform and tax cut bill that went through, which we all as North Carolinians live with today. I would say for the good. That was a great change to our tax system. But I also did a lot of work on the environment, particularly the state's climate change policies, regulation, and so on. But we also had a great team there that I worked with, doing education policy at the time, Terry Stoops and John Sanders doing regulatory policy and others. So we had a great team there. I really enjoyed being there for all those years and working with John Hood. And it was a fantastic experience. And I learned an awful lot doing it, both just in the act of doing my own research, but also associating with the great researchers that I had to work with at the time there.
Well, we appreciate your service and all the great work you did for John Locke Foundation. I think you and I maybe met originally when I was doing some work on energy policy here in North Carolina. That was back in the day when we were trying to get fracking approved here in North Carolina. And still great friends with our friend John Hood. He was on the show back in January talking about what's going on in the country. And next week, I'll actually have Mitch Kocok on the show.
Mitch is a great guy.
And so much happened around the state, so it just seemed like the right time to have a conversation with Mitch. But I guess to get started, Roy, my first question would be, like, let's start at a high level here. How would you currently describe the state of the United States economy?
Well, I think it's a real mixed bag. I think there's a lot of uncertainty, and especially the war is creating even more uncertainty. On the regulatory front, I think it's gotten a lot healthier, especially in the area of energy. Broadly speaking, regulations, although I think this administration is too anxious to use things like, antitrust policy, to go after, what he sees as peccadilloes of, you know, big industry. Certainly on the tax front, I think we're headed toward a better tax regime than we would have had otherwise. When I say that, I mean, if the so-called Big Beautiful Bill wasn't passed last year, we would have gone back to the tax rates and tax system we had pre-2017. So the tax reforms of the first Trump tax reforms would have all gone away. So keeping those tax cuts and reforms in place was a huge, huge thing. They refer to it as a tax cut, and it kept things the way they were, rather than letting it was an avoidance of a very large tax increase. I think one of the big additions that was made last summer was the broadening of expensing, allowing companies to deduct investment expenditures on capital equipment and so on immediately, rather than having to write it off over time, which makes sense from a tax policy perspective, and also is a great boon for investment. So on that front, yes, I think things are great. I think the massive distortions, I think, are being put into the economy through tariffs. Low, we'll see how this plays out. I think the Supreme Court did us all a great favor, and the administration a great favor. They've been a look at it that way, but they're a great favor by getting rid of its first ones.
Yeah, I'm going to get specific to tariffs here in just a moment. Mm-hmm. I want to stay with the just sort of the macro economy at large.
Sure.
And I agree with your comments.
Well, tariffs affect that. So
I agree with your comments around tax policy, and also believe that the accelerated depreciation is great, you know, for small and middle market companies. We just recently got a report that many of the job numbers going back to December have been revised, and sort of pointing to maybe more softness within the labor market than we originally thought. Roy, what are your thoughts about what's going on with the current labor market? I mean, is it as strong as the administration continues to project?
Well, I'm just looking at what everybody looks at. I mean, I don't have any, you know, I think there are, you know, we're seeing things that are supposed to be getting better because of tariffs. Again, it's hard to separate out tariffs. Like, allegedly, that was supposed to bring back manufacturing, and yet we had $72,000 jobs lost in 2025. Job growth was smaller in 2025 than it was in 2024. So, yeah, I think this is part of the overall distortions that are put in the economy. So, on the other hand, you know, the unemployment, we have full employment, 4 point whatever it is, 2-3%. That's full employment. So there certainly isn't an unemployment problem. But I think it's something that needs to be watched. As these tax policies kick in, we can see more investment, more job growth. It remains to be seen, I think.
You know, many people describe the economy right now as being K-shaped, meaning that the top 1-5% are basically supporting consumption within the economy. Do you share that same perspective, or?
I don't know. To be honest, I haven't looked at those numbers, and I don't know. I'm not a believer that that consumption is the, you know, end all be all. I'm not a Keynesian. But to be honest, I don't know how it divides up this consumption component of GDP divides up among, people have more money are obviously going to spend more on consumption, and they're also going to save more, right? So, if that's different than it ever has been, I mean, if that the lower the middle income people or whatever are spending proportionally less on consumption they have in the past. I honestly don't know.
Do you think if let's sort of play that out? Let's say that is true.
But even if they are, I'm not sure that's a problem.
Yeah, and that's
I'm not sure why that. I'd have to understand why that matters. Maybe if you're spending less of your income on consumption, it means you're saving more. That's what it means. So why is it a problem for middle income people to be spending less of their income on consumption and putting more into savings? I mean, disposable income is divided between consumption and savings. So I honestly don't understand why that would be a problem.
Well, I'll tell you why I think it's a problem. I don't think the math is just that simple. I think the reason that low and middle income families are spending less on consumption is because they have less disposable income. I don't think it's
that's a different story. That's a different story.
But I think that's the story.
If you have less disposable income, that means what, taxes are higher, or their wages aren't. In real terms, aren't what they were. Okay, so that's really a different issue than they're putting less of their. If they have less disposable income, it means they're putting less in consumption and less in savings, probably. But if what you're saying, you're saying people have less income overall,
yeah.
I don't think disposable incomes have been falling. I mean, maybe they have. It's not a number.
I would agree. I would agree. Let me jump in there. I would agree with you. I don't think the income numbers are falling. I think the income numbers are staying stagnant. I think the prices are going higher, and people have less disposable.
Yeah, well, that's why I said real income. That's why I said real income.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. Inflation erodes. Inflation erodes income, causes a real income to decline. And if wages aren't, and we've been being told by the administration that real income is that wages are surpassing income, that real income is rising. I don't know how to go from there. I accept that those numbers that real income right now is real wages. Real wages are going up faster than inflation, 2.4% or whatever inflation is.
Yeah, I think inflation's running at 2.7 right now. But you know, let's shift to it.
I just heard this morning yesterday's numbers was 2.4 for the CPI.
Okay. Well, let's shift to the conversation around inflation. I mean, with the war breaking out in Iran, talk about from an economic standpoint what we might see happen with inflation.
It depends on how the war is funded. Inflation is, as Milton Friedman said, a monetary phenomenon. If the war is funded by the printing press, then it will be inflationary. If it isn't, then it won't. I mean, that's kind of the, it might cause, it clearly is causing some prices to go up, right? That's not inflation. So, obviously price of gasoline is going up. How long that will be the case, you know, who knows? If it's short term, if it's a regular, relatively short economy, a short term thing, I don't see it as a huge problem, but people suffer in the short term. And the longer it goes, the worse that's going to be. Wars typically that go on for a period of time, I don't want to say the war causes inflation because wars don't per se cause inflation, but what happens is they get monetized by the Federal Reserve, new money, which You know, we had the Vietnam War and look at the inflation in the 70s, right? The Federal Reserve prints a lot of money to fund the fund wars. And that's where the inflation tends to come from. So it remains to be seen how this war gets funded, how long it lasts. If it gets funded through debt, which is basically what's going to happen, I don't see a big tax increase because of it. So if it gets funded through debt, then I think that raises the probability that it will, because the Fed monetizes debt, that it will cause higher inflation.
Yeah, I don't see how it would get funded any other way. I mean, when you've got a country that's $38 trillion in debt and running $1 trillion annual deficits and just refuses to get their financial house in order, it's definitely going to be funded through deficit spending, and it is going to get monetized through the Federal Reserve. And I think it's definitely going to cause inflation to shoot up. And I also think the other caveat that we're dealing with in this particular conflict that's different is that we're dealing with a fairly oil-rich nation that controls a strait where 20% of the global oil supply comes from. And so if this conflict continues to deepen, without question, I believe you're going to have global inflation, not just particularly inflation here in the United States. I know you've been very vocal about tariffs, and I know you were wanting to go down that road a moment ago, so I want to come back to that as well. You know, from an audience that may not have a fundamental or economic understanding of tariffs, what are tariffs designed to actually accomplish?
Well, depends on who's designing them, of course. More often than not, they are designed to protect a domestic industry from, I like to argue, the decisions of domestic consumers. Right. Domestic consumers decide that for whatever reason, higher quality, lower prices, whatever, they prefer to be buying a particular product or some products from producers in a foreign country. Tariffs are put in place to protect the domestic consumers from that competitive pressure put to them by the decisions of consumers. So that's why they call it protectionism, right? Now, typically we think, well, it's protection. It's to protect domestic producers from foreign producers. No, foreign producers can't force us to buy anything, right? It's to protect the domestic producers from our decisions, right? I like to buy imported pasta from Italy, okay? When they put a tariff on, they're protecting domestic producers of pasta from my decision to buy pasta from Italy. Ultimately, they're designed to protect domestic industry from competition. Sometimes they are also designed to raise revenue, but then that's a trade-off, right? If people decide to buy fewer foreign products, then that revenue shrinks. I mean, if it's a revenue raiser, then you have to keep those imports up to raise the revenue, right? Otherwise, people aren't paying the taxes. So there's that trade-off between the protectionist motive and the revenue-raising motive.
And I guess go a little bit further and talk about how they actually affect economic growth in our country.
Well, there's a number of ways it affects economic. It reduces economic growth. Tariffs reduce economic growth. First of all, when you reduce competition, you reduce efficiency. Firms that don't face as much competition aren't as efficient in their production. Second of all, they draw resources. People don't realize this. But what they do is, resources are scarce. All resources are scarce. And if we as a country have to use more resources to produce one thing, it means we can't use those resources to produce other things. So I look at an import. If I buy, well, going back to pasta, if I buy a pound of pasta from Italy, that means the resources that would have gone to producing that pasta in the United States are now being freed up to produce other things. The wheat, the farm equipment, the whatever it is, get freed up to produce other things. So what happens is they divert resources from less efficient, more efficient uses to less efficient uses, right? So that's another way that they tariffs shrink economic growth. And they raise prices. Look, to me and you, if we have to spend more on one thing, it means we spend less on something else.
That's right.
Right. If I have to spend more on a pound of pasta, that means there's that much less I can spend on something else. And so less of something else gets produced. I recommend that people read Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. There's a very famous, what he calls the broken window fallacy in there. And it talks about this whole situation. People have to spend more on one thing. They're spending money on less efficient things. That means they're spending less money on more efficient things.
And just to add, I also think that by having free trade, in my opinion, and I've been accused of being a globalist and all these other names and labels that are out there, that's fine. I think in a free trade environment, it also allows countries to focus on what they're actually really good at. And I think in America, we're really good when it comes to advanced manufacturing and high quality technology type industries. And I don't think we want to have our workers focused on making toys and the kind of cheap goods that, quite frankly, we can allow China to make. It just seems like that makes the most sense to me.
It's what economists call comparative advantage. The countries should focus on what they're more efficient, better at doing, and trade with other countries for what they're more efficient at doing. Absolutely. That's David Ricardo's famous contribution to economics, one of many.
When you listen to President Trump, he says tariffs, first of all, is his favorite word in the dictionary. He's also said countless times that he thinks tariffs makes the country strong. When I listen to you describe the trend, it sounds like you feel like it makes the country weaker. So how is the president squaring the advice that he's receiving from the economists around them? Are they just simply reading different books than what you read?
I don't know if they're reading books. For one thing, most of the people around them aren't economists. And maybe they are reading different books. Look, if they've been reading John Maynard Keynes's general theory, right, which dominated a lot of the economics profession for a long time, if they were Keynesians, which is basically a more moderate version of socialism, then Keynes was for tariffs for all the reasons that Trump, in that sense, Trump is a Keynesian. Because Keynes was in many ways a mercantilist. Maybe that's what they're reading, and they're not reading Milton Friedman or Adam Smith or Friedrich Hayek or the free market economist. He's not surrounded by free market economists to the extent he's surrounded by economists. Most of the people aren't. Hassett is, but he is. I think he's just decided to ignore all the good economics he once knew. And Trump himself has a set of sort of views about tariffs that are really rooted in 17th century, 1600s economics. I mean, pre-Adam Smith economics, the views about trade deficits as being somehow bad for the economy, or dollar outflows, of being concerned about dollars flowing out of the country by buying goods and services. These are really fallacies rooted as I said, 17th century economics, pre-modern economics, that have been just, I mean, the economics profession has rejected these, well, basically 250 years ago. But Trump seems to hold fast to them.
Well, you know, the Supreme Court just ruled against the use of these emergency tariffs. They didn't necessarily strike down all the tariffs, but just that one program under Section 232. A federal judge or federal court just ruled that the administration will have to pay some money back to all these companies that pay these tariffs. I think there's about $175 billion that have been paid in. What was your reaction to those two rulings?
Oh, I was thrilled. And I think he's going to get shot down on that. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a constitutional scholar by any stretch, but I think he's also going to get shot down in these Section 122 tariffs that he's now trying to substitute. I was very glad. I was rooting for the small businessman that brought this lawsuit against government. And that he would, just sort of as an aside, I think about this, and it's kind of ridiculous. You think back to the State of the Union address. Here we had a businessman, small businessman, who brought the lawsuit against the government on these tariffs, saying that he was harmed by the tariffs, and won the case. This was a small businessman fighting against big government, right? And he was sitting with the Democrats, as a guest of the Democrats, at the State of the Union address. The Republicans should be embarrassed that here it is, a small businessman just won a big case against big government intrusion into his business. And he's a guest of the Democrats. To me, that turns the world upside down.
It definitely feels like the world is upside down, quite frankly. And there's just a tremendous amount of uncertainty at every turn and every corner. I think these tariffs and a lot of the things that we're talking about right now continues to add to that uncertainty. I've just got a few more questions for you, Roy, before we run out of time. I do want to ask a question about the dollar. I mean, when you look at the value of the dollar, I mean, there's just continued weakening of the dollar. Do you think this is being done intentionally?
By the government?
By the administration. I mean.
Well, it's. Let me say this is not an expertise area for me, but I'm not sure what do you think they're doing, I guess, to weaken the dollar. You have to do something. What is it that they're doing?
Well, I mean, when you listen to the pundits on Bloomberg, they just talk about that this administration seems to believe that the dollar was weaker, that our manufacturing would increase. And so there seems
to be believe, but believing it doesn't make it happen. You have to do something. And Trump may very well want a weaker dollar, but we have a refloating exchange rate. And unless he takes some actions, I mean, it does go in hand with his views that he wants a more inflationary monetary policy. It is consistent with that, but he doesn't control the Fed. He can jawbone the Fed, but he doesn't control them. So I'm not sure what he can do. In temporary things, he can make statements or whatever that might weaken the dollar for some short period of time. But in terms of some sort of long-term thing, it needs some more concrete policy change. And I don't think he has those levers.
Well, maybe it's just being done unattended then, because I mean, it's a phenomenon that's occurring. And I also think that, you know, when we demonize our allies and our international partners, and we make them feel like this is no longer a safe place, and right. they start to hold less dollars as in their reserves, that certainly begins to weaken the dollar. And I think you've got a lot of countries now talking about the dollar shouldn't be the world's reserve currency any longer.
Yeah. And yes, that's right. And in that sense, I mean, I do think he is the tariffs and the erraticness of the tariffs, right? I mean, he came out with these huge ones, and then they were lowered, and it's different for different countries, and they're changing constantly. If you're doing business, you don't want to have to deal with that, and you look for other trading partners where that you can consider to be more reliable. And I think clearly that is something that it hurts consumers too. I mean,
I'll add this too. I don't know if the average American thinks about this all the time, and this is for my audience, but you know, our capital markets in America are the deepest and most diverse because everybody around the world holds dollars, and they end up putting that money back into our capital markets. We utilize right. our capital markets to finance our economy and our companies and all the expansion and growth that we have in this country. But we have a very outsized portion of we control an outsized proportion of the world's capital. Because of the certainty and the things that we've done so long in this country, and it just feels like over the last year, a lot of that is being intentionally destroyed.
Well, in this sense, I mean, if you're trying to discourage imports, then you are also discouraging capital investment into this country, because where do people get money outside the country to invest in the country, right? They get it by selling us stuff. So if you're telling American consumers and you're trying to keep people from buying imports, what you're doing is, and it really runs contrary to Trump's rhetoric, because he's trying to go out and get all this this capital investment into the country, while at the same time telling Americans don't spend money on foreign goods. You can't have both. And the money that goes out of the country, right? If you consider that a problem, I don't, because we get goods and services in exchange for it. But if your goal is to get more capital investment from foreigners, they have to have the dollars to do that with, and they get those dollars by selling us stuff. So, you are simultaneously weakening foreign investment in the U.S. by discouraging, taking special policy steps to discourage imports of goods and services.
You know, Roy, what are your thoughts as we continue? I mean, we're wrapping up the first quarter of 2026. Time's moving fast. Do you see anything out on the horizon that would indicate we might be heading into a recessionary environment?
Well, I think the war, I mean, so much hinges on this war right now. And where it takes us, how long it goes. I mean, if the war continues and is not over, I would argue pretty quickly, it could. And again, I'm a believer in what's called the Austrian theory of business cycle. So that depends on, again, what the Fed does. If the Fed floods the money, floods the economy with new money to pay for the war, then that sets off a business cycle, which ends up in a recession. I think that any war comes as a clear-cut possibility.
You know, where I want to land on my last question, I'm going to bring it home here to North Carolina. You know, we've experienced strong population and business growth right here in North Carolina. Past, I think, 4 years, 4 or 5 years straight, we've been voted one of the best states to do business in. What economic factors are driving that success, and what risks should policymakers be mindful of?
I think it's always the same two things, taxation and regulation. We have a really good tax system in North Carolina. When you look at the rest of the country, we have a low income tax. Our regulatory environment is pretty good. I think if we change that, for example, if we, you know, have tax increases, or if there's movement to with more regulation on the let's say the environment front, which was a big deal in the early 2000s. We were pushing environmental regulations in the state really strongly. You know, that can change, but otherwise, and some has to do with what other states do, right? If other states, you know, suddenly New York starts cutting their taxes and deregulating, you know, we might see a lot less of that investment and interest in states like North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, Texas. It's right now we're very competitive with respect to other states. So, and that's a good thing.
You know, Roy, this has been a thoughtful conversation. I appreciate you taking the time to walk us through these economic forces and help our audience better understand what's happening beneath the headlines. And to everyone watching or listening, thank you for being part of this growing community of thoughtful conversations. If you believe discussions like this are valuable, I encourage you to support the work. Your contribution helps us continue bringing economists, business leaders, and policy thinkers onto the show to help us all better understand the world we're living in. You can visit LockedIn.cash to become a supporter. You can also subscribe to my podcast on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify. Share this episode and send it to someone who cares about the future of North Carolina. Most importantly, stay tuned to WTOB, because every Sunday morning you can lock in with me. I'm Algernon Cash, and y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WGC. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.